Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to do in this audio Job chapter 34, verses 1 through 37. We will call this chapter Elihu Asserts God's Justice. Now, our context is this. We're in the middle of several chapters, starting in chapter 32, where Elihu shows up. He's one of the, we shall call him the four false friends. I don't know. I don't want to call Elihu a false friend. He was a lot nicer than the other three. Well, he's the young guy who shows up in our little drama here. He starts in chapter 32 rebuking Job's three false friends, either because they were trying to say that Job had sinned when he hadn't, or because they had failed to convict Job of his sin and had failed to get Job to repent. But for whatever reason, Elihu jumps on Job's three friends, and then in chapter 33, he turns on Job. Now, I've gone through a bunch of possibilities as to what Elihu was upset about with Job. Option number one, he's upset that Job has committed a secret sin, which he hasn't confessed, just like the other three friends are accusing him of. That's option number one. Or option number two, he hasn't, or at least Elihu doesn't know, that Job has committed a secret sin to cause all the suffering to come on his head. However, he has dealt with God irreverently, maybe even blasphemously, when he has attacked God. Job has attacked God by saying, "Where are you, God? Why won't you let me into your courtroom to plead my case?" The third possibility is why Elihu is angry at Job is because Elihu thinks that God is just trying to test Job, trying to mold him, trying to make him stronger with all of these trials, and Job refuses the discipline of his father. But for whatever reason it is, Elihu will not grant Job's contention that he's innocent in this affair. Now, Elihu has a better argument than the other three, because you could say that Job was a little bit rough on God with his language and demanding an answer from God. In fact, at the end of the book, we're going to see that God rebukes Job just for that. So Elihu is partially right here, at least if that's what he was complaining about, Job's attitude toward God. And many people think that's what he was complaining about, but it's not exactly perfectly clear. Well, we continue now in chapter 34, where Elihu is going to assert God's justice. And of course, the idea is, Job, God is just, you are not. You need to confess something, whatever it is, you need to confess. So poor old Job, he's going to get beaten down again. People telling him he's a miserable sinner. This on top of the fact he's lost all of his money, all of his children. His wife's told him to curse God and die, so he's lost her support. And he's also sick. He's covered with boils from head to foot. We start now in Job 34, 1 through 7. Then Elihu continued, saying, "Hear my words, you wise men, and listen to me, you knowledgeable ones. Doesn't the ear test words as the palate taste food? Let us judge for ourselves what is right. Let us decide together what is good. For Job has declared," quote, this is Job speaking now, according to Elihu, quote, "I am righteous, yet God has deprived me of justice. Would I lie about my case? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job? He drinks derision like water." Well, let me stop at the end of verse 6. Job says, "My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression." Job, being quoted by Elihu, stops there. And then verse 7, Elihu quits quoting Job, and he says, on his own account, "What man is like Job? He drinks derision like water." Now, in verse 1, it says, Elihu continued from chapter 33, where Elihu has been rebuking Job. He continued. Someone has speculated he probably paused a long time to allow Job to answer, which Job didn't. So Elihu continues. And he says, "Hear my words, you wise men." Well, Elihu could have been talking to some unnamed bystanders, as Gill suggests, but I think more likely he's speaking to the three false friends, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest. Now, the problem with Elihu calling the three false friends wise men, as John Gill points out, is that Elihu didn't think they were so wise. He had just finished blasting them in chapter 32, saying they didn't know what they were talking about. They were not able to answer Job. So Elihu doesn't think they were wise. Well, that's true, but I'm sure that Elihu was talking sarcastically here. "Hear my words, you so-called wise men." So here we have Elihu not only speaking to Job, but he's speaking to the wise men also. Elihu says in verse 3, "Doesn't the ear test words as the palate tastes food?" In other words, you're eating food, your palate is where your taste buds are, and you say, is this good steak? Is this a good hamburger? Oh, this is lousy asparagus. And the analogy is this. When you hear doctrines, you say, is that a good doctrine? Is that a bad doctrine? Doctrines are like meat. Some meat is good and some meat is bad, as Adam Clark says. Now, Elihu is actually quoting Job, because Job said the same thing in Job chapter 12, verse 11. Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes its food? And so Elihu is saying, well, let's examine some doctrines here and see who's right. In fact, he says that in verse 4, let us judge for ourselves what is right. Let us decide together what is good. So he's asking for the three false friends and Job and Elihu to decide. Who's right in this matter? Is Job right or not? Then he quotes Job verse 5, for Job has declared, I am righteous. Now we've shown that Job has said that over and over again. I have not done anything wrong to deserve this. Yet God has deprived me of justice. NIV has, but God denies me justice. Now Job is sort of complaining about God. God, why did you do this to me? It's not right. It's not fair. Now Job is stepping over the line when he does that. And Elihu's going to point that out. Still quoting Job, Elihu says in verse 6, would I lie about my case? The NIV translates it, Job saying this, although I am right, I am considered a liar. Adam Clark paraphrases it this way, should I acknowledge myself the sinner which they paint me, and thus lie against my right to assert and maintain my innocence? In other words, Job is saying, I'm not going to lie about all that's happened here. I'm not going to say I did something to deserve this, that you've been beating me over the head for 30 chapters trying to tell me to confess my sin. I'm not going to do it. Let me just give you one example of the times that Job asserts his innocence in the previous chapters. Job 27, verse 5. Job is speaking, far be it from me that I should declare you right, you false friends, right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. In other words, I'll die before I confess that I did anything to deserve this because I didn't. Now in verse 7, Elihu is finished quoting Job, who says, my wound is incurable, although I am without transgression. Once that's another example, a summary of Job's statements. I didn't do anything. I am without transgression. And then in verse 7, Elihu says, what man is like Job? He drinks derision like water. Now what does Elihu mean here? Two options. Option 1, Job drinks in scorn for God like a parched man in the desert takes in water. So on that option, Job's derision is derision toward God. And Elihu is saying Job drinks derision like water. In other words, he pours it down his gullet like water. Thirsty man drinking a lot of water. Job is deriding God in just the same amount. Well, now, if that's the take we take on this, the NIV Study Bible and Clark suggests that's the way to go, or at least that's a good possibility. If that is true, then all of a sudden Elihu doesn't sound quite as reasonable as he did in the several chapters previous. He sounds just as accusatory as the three false friends. Job, you're deriding God. Well, it could be, except the difference might be that Elihu doesn't think that Job did anything before the calamity, but that he is doing things after the calamity that are sinful. But there's another option on how to read this. Job drinks derision like water. It could be that Elihu means that Job is drinking up derision from his friends. As John Gill puts it, quote, for a foolish and wicked man to do so is not strange nor uncommon, but for a man of such sense and grace as Job was, to do this was astonishing, to have no more regard to his character than to expose himself to the scorn and ridicule of men. So Job is just sitting there taking it, like water being poured down his gullet. Derision is being poured into his ears by his three false friends and Elihu. That would save Elihu from turning to be totally unreasonable all of a sudden, which some people think is a little bit out of character. I'll leave that question open as we turn to Job chapter 34, verses 8 and 9. Elihu continues, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? For he has said, and now Elihu quotes Job again, for Job has said, quote, it profits a man nothing when he is pleased with God. In other words, Job is saying that God doesn't reward his friends. The people he's pleased with, God kicks them in the teeth instead of rewarding him. That's what Job is accused of saying. As the NIV Study Bible says, Elihu now seems to assume the same as the three false friends assume, that Job is sinning before God, and that's what caused God to punish him. But remember, there is always the possibility that Elihu is not rebuking Job for sinning previous to his calamity, but that he is rather rebuking Job in response to Job's calamity in the way that he's dealing with God after the calamity started. Now, what is Elihu concerned about? Well, if Job is going around questioning God's moral governance of the universe, if Job is saying that God does not reward those who please God, he's also saying that God does not punish those who do wicked. Well, that is giving false comfort to the wicked, because then the wicked could hear Job and say, well, God doesn't punish sin. Well, let's go out and be wicked some more. I'm going to read you three quotations from three different commentators that more or less express the same idea. Here's what John Gill says. The sense is that by his words, by Job's words, the expressions that dropped from his lips, he seemed to agree with wicked people and to be of the same sentiments with them, and what he delivered tended to encourage and harden them in their sinful ways. Clark says, quote, when Job says, I am righteous, yet God hath taken away my judgment, in other words, I'm righteous, yet God doesn't reward my righteousness, that, according to Clark, is according to the assertion of sinners who say there is no profit in serving God. For if a man be righteous, he is not benefited by it, for God has not vindicated just man's cause against his oppressors. Clark continues, by adopting so much of their creed, Elihu intimates that Job is taking the steps that lead to fellowship with the wicked. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, Job virtually goes in company, makes common cause with the wicked by taking up their sentiments, or at least by saying that those who act on such sentiments are unpunished. To deny God's righteous government because we do not see the reasons of his acts is virtually to take part with the ungodly. Now, that's unfair to Job, because Job also has said in several chapters that God is just. He rules the world with justice. But what Job was saying, he doesn't always do it. Ultimately, yes, the wicked are going to be punished and the righteous will be rewarded, but Job never said that that wasn't going to happen. He did say, quite properly, that you can look around and you will see wicked people prospering and you can see righteous people suffering, and I am one of the latter, Job says, so lay off my case. It's amazing to me the wild charges that are brought against Job, that Job is now encouraging sin. Now, Elihu apparently has completely ignored Job's previous statements that, yes, God does punish sin. As the NIV Study Bible in chapter 24, Job spent a lot of time railing against the activity of wicked men. And I'll just give you another quote in Job 21, verses 16 through 18. This is what Job says. But there, the wicked's prosperity is not of their own doing. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Job is saying, I don't want to have anything to do with saying I can sin and get away with it. Verse 17 of Job 21. Job continues, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Does disaster come on them? Does he apportion destruction in his anger? Are they like straw before the wind, like chaff a storm sweeps away? Those are rhetorical questions, the answer to which Job expects to be a yes. How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Yes, the wicked get their lamps put out. Disaster comes on them. God apportions destruction in his anger towards them. They're like straw before the wind. They're like chaff a storm sweeps away. And then in verse 20, Job 21, Job says, let his, the wicked's, own eyes see his demise. Let him drink from the Almighty's wrath. So Job knows that God punishes evil. So Elihu is being totally unfair with Job here. So when Elihu says that Job goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men, that is a totally outrageous charge. It is unfair. It ignores what Job has said previously. So we go now to Job chapter 34, verses 10 through 15. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Elihu still speaking. You men of understanding would be the three false friends. It is impossible for God to do wrong and for the Almighty to act unjustly. Oh, that's a deep statement. For God repays a person according to his deeds, and he brings his ways on him. Indeed, it is true that God does not act wickedly, and the Almighty does not pervert justice. Who gave him authority over the earth? Who put him in charge of the entire world? If he put his mind to it and withdrew the spirit and breath he gave, every living thing would perish together, and mankind would return to the dust. Now, Elihu here in verses 10 through 15 speaks a truism. God is just. Job doesn't disagree with that. I just finished reading you verses from Job chapter 21 where Job agrees with Elihu. So Elihu is not stating anything further that would condemn Job. It is impossible for God to do wrong. Elihu says, is he intimating that Job was accusing God of doing wrong? Probably so. Now the NIV Study Bible says that Elihu was faced with three possible explanations of Job's situation. One, God was unjust and cruel. Well, of course, that's not true. I haven't even brought that up as a possible accusation that Job believes that, because that's so absurd. Option number two, Elihu could be thinking that Job is thinking that God is a loving God, but he's impotent to stop the suffering. Well, Job never said that. But if Elihu thinks that, that's foolish to think that an omnipotent God is not loving. Of course, the third option is God was punishing Job for something, either a pre-calamity sin or a post-calamity sin, but for something, God's punishing Job. And of course, I think it's number three. That's what Elihu thinks. Job, you need to repent. Maybe not repent of what the three false friends were accusing you of, but you did something, so let's repent. Now, of course, there was a fourth option, is to explain Job's situation, which was not mentioned by anybody. And that is, God had allowed Satan to test Job in chapter 1. You remember that. Satan says the only reason Job loves you is because you've blessed him so much. You take away all of his stuff and he'll curse you to your face. And God said, okay, we'll see that. We'll see if that's true. So you test him, Satan, but you don't kill him, but you test him. But now Elihu didn't know that. So that idea was not presented to Elihu's mind, trying to figure out why Job is suffering so much. Now, of course, all this is of great instruction to present-day Christians, because we know that God will allow the devil to test us. We know that. Experientially, we know that. And we just need to be reminded that God has put a rein on the devil, will allow the test to go so far and no further, because we know in the New Testament that there is no trial known to man which God is not able to deliver you from. I think in 2 Corinthians 10, is it that Paul said that? No trial that God is not able to deliver you from. Deliver us this day from our temptations, as the Lord's Prayer says. God will deliver us. God delivered Job. Job just didn't have a reason, but we know the reason now. Now, in verse 13, Elihu says, well, let's go back to verse 11. Elihu repays a person according to his deeds. Check. Everybody knows that. He brings his ways, God's ways, on the unjust. Yes, no problem. Verse 12, God does not act wickedly. Whoa, no kidding. And the Almighty does not pervert justice. Whoa, big surprise. Then in verse 13, rhetorical questions come. Elihu asks, who can give God authority over the earth? In other words, nobody gave God authority over the earth, because he is the ultimate supreme authority. Who put him in charge of the entire world? Nobody, because God is in charge of the entire world, and there is nobody in charge of God. Verse 14, if God put his mind to it and withdrew the spirit and breath he gave, every living thing would perish. In other words, God is the author of life. Spirit is life. Withdrew the spirit, withdrew the life and breath. Spirit and breath are actually synonyms. Ruach, I think it is. I don't know if that's the Hebrew. I shouldn't have even said that. But the point is that if God withdrew life, we would die. In other words, we have to have God in order to even exist. If it wasn't for God maintaining the life on this planet, all of mankind would return to the dust, would return to the grave and die. That's how big God is. No problem. Job believes that. We go now to Job 34, verses 16 through 20. Now, here, Elihu will turn his attention to Job individually. He says in verse 16, but if you, Job, he doesn't say Job, but that's what he means. But if you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Shall one who hates justice rule? And will you condemn the righteous mighty one, who says to a king, worthless one, to nobles, wicked ones, who shows no partiality to princes, nor regards the rich above the poor, for they are all the work of his hands. In a moment they die, and at midnight people are shaken and pass away, and the mighty are taken away without a hand. Now, Elihu in verse 16 says, Job, if you have understanding, now that can mean if there is a possibility that you have understanding, or it could mean since you have understanding. That's always a little ambiguous. I really think he's saying since you have understanding, that's what he means, since you've been talking so big, Job, about how you've maintained your integrity and your righteousness. All right, well, I want you to listen to me. Listen to the sound of my words. Now, he's quoting himself, Elihu is here. Shall one who hates justice rule? In other words, somebody like you, Job, should you rule anywhere? And are you going to condemn the righteous mighty one? You're going to condemn God because God won't tell you why you're suffering? This God who says to a king, verse 18, worthless one, in other words, a mighty and exalted king, compared to God is worthless. To nobles, high and mighty nobles, but compared to God, they're wicked ones. This God who shows no partiality to princes, God is not impressed by rich people, powerful people. He doesn't care. He's God. As 1 Samuel 2:7 says, the Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He makes people rich. He makes them poor. He doesn't care as far as who has more worth or who is right in a case against him. For they all, the rich and the poor, are the work of his hands. He made them all, rich and poor. Verse 20, in a moment they die, even if they're rich, bam, they can go. And at midnight people are shaken and pass away. And the mighty are taken away without a hand. That means they just die without any obvious cause. Nobody kills them with their hands. They just die. So no matter how rich and powerful somebody is, bam, he could go just like that. God is not impressed by rich people and their power because they're pitifully weak when they die, just like the poor person is. So Job, why are you criticizing this God? That's Elihu's thrust. We go now to Job 34, verses 21 through 24. Elihu continues, for his, God's, for God's eyes are upon the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. There is no darkness or deep shadow where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves, for he does not need to consider a man further that he should go before God in judgment. He breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry, and sets others in their place. Verse 21, his eyes are upon the ways of man means that God's always looking down here to decide who's right and who's wrong, and if somebody's wrong, they're going to get punished for it. That's what Elihu was saying, and Job doesn't disagree with that. God sees all of man's steps. He sees what he does down here. No problem. Verse 22, there's no darkness or deep shadow where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. Again, Elihu is kicking against the false allegation that Job thinks that evil people can just get away with murder and God has absconded from his rule over the moral universe. No, Job has not said that, but Elihu keeps beating a straw man here. Workers of iniquity can't hide from God's justice. Verse 23, God does not need to consider a man further, Elihu says. What does that mean? Most probably, it means, as Gill and Clark say, that God does not suffer the wicked to have an appeal before God. In other words, God does not need to consider a man further. In other words, okay, I judge a wicked man to be evil. And the wicked man says, well, God, I want to appeal that decision. Nope, there's no court of appeals with God. He doesn't need to consider your case any further because he knows whether you're right or wrong instantly because he's God. So no need to consider a man further that he should go before God in judgment. In other words, in an appeal to God. The implication, of course, that Elihu is making is that Job was already judged by means of his calamities. So there's no need for Job to go further and appeal to God and say, why is this happening to me? Because Job is already judged. At least that's the implication. Verse 24, he breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry. Isn't that what happened to you, Job? You were a mighty man. You're now broken in pieces. And you have not been able to inquire of God why that has happened. Well, that's what God does. He sets others in their place. He sets people in their place. You've been set in your place. So what are you complaining about? What God has laid on you, Job, has been perfectly fair and just. Now, Elihu is actually saying here that he doesn't think that Job has even a right to complain to God, to ask God. And I think that's ridiculous. If you have a relationship with God, you have a right to go to him and ask, why is all this bad stuff happening to me? Gosh, if I didn't have God to go through trials, I think I would be a depressed atheist pagan. You need to go to God when things are bad. And Elihu is saying, don't you talk back to God. Don't you say anything to him. Don't you even ask. Now, there's one thing about complaining to God, and there's another thing to ask God. There's two different things. If you say, God, you have no right. I've served you all my life, and all this bad stuff is happening to me, and it's not right. It's not fair. Don't you should never do that. But going to God and saying, God, I don't understand. Please help me. Is this discipline? Why is this happening to me? You've got every right to do that. In fact, you should do that. But Elihu is not giving Job much benefit of doubt. We go now to Job 34, verses 25 through 30. Elihu continues, therefore, God recognizes their deeds, recognizes the deeds of the wicked, and God overthrows the wicked by night, and they are crushed. In full view of the public, he strikes them for their wickedness, because they turned aside from following him and did not understand any of his ways, but caused the poor to cry out to him, and he heard the outcry of the afflicted. What that means is evil people oppress the poor, and that's what caused the poor to cry out to God. And God heard their cry. Verse 29, but when God is silent, who can declare him guilty? When he hides his face, who can see him? Yet he watches over both individuals and nations, so that godless men should not rule or ensnare the people. So what Elihu is saying here is, look, God rules. You don't need to know. God is silent. You can't declare him guilty. And of course, he's implying that Job is declaring God guilty. I don't think Job ever said God was guilty. He's just saying, why are you allowing this to happen to me? I guess you could argue that Job is implying that God is guilty for letting these bad things happen. If he did, that's not right. That's wrong. And so Elihu would have a good argument here. You can't declare God guilty just because he's not answering you, Job. And that's true. God himself says here at the end of the book, when we get there, who are you, Job? Who made the sea? Who made the mountains? Don't complain to me. There's a difference, though, between complaining and asking. God never rebuked Job for asking him what was going on. So Elihu continues at the end of verse 29, God watches over both individuals and nations. In other words, he is the moral governor of the universe, so that godless men should not rule. If it wasn't for God, the evil people would take over the world. Now, it seems to me that Job could answer Elihu here, oh, really? Godless men should not rule? Job could say, well, ultimately, that's true, because God's world is God's world, and the godless will not take it over. But what about Stalin? What about Pol Pot? What about Mao Zedong? What about Xi Jinping? What about certain people in America? I won't mention their names. But godless people do rule. We have godless people ruling America right now. Totally godless. Totally anti-Christian. And they're ensnaring the people. And all Job would have to do is point out the examples in his realm of experience and say, look here, Elihu, how do you answer that? The NIV Study Bible agrees with me there. That is a matter of palpable fact. Godless men do rule all over the world. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says, quote, we know, however, that God allows evil people to attain positions of authority. Jesus told Pontius Pilate, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Oh, God gave power to Pontius Pilate, who executed Jesus? The NIV Study Bible continues, perhaps God allows the godless to rule to test the loyalty of those who claim to follow him. But even if the wicked rule, God remains in control. So there's just subtle distinctions there. It's not that the unrighteous rule or they don't rule. It's not that we have perfect government among men or that we have perfectly awful government among men. It's sometimes one and sometimes the other. But even if it's evil people ruling, God is controlling them. He's sovereign. He's behind them. And that is something that Elihu has not seen. I don't think any of these characters have seen that. Now, in verse 29, Elihu says, when God is silent, who can declare him guilty? Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about that. The silence of God is a difficult thing for a suffering person to endure. Why would God remain hidden when his comforting presence is needed the most? Perhaps because the answer to a person's suffering is so complex that God does not ask that person to try to understand it. Instead, God silently sustains that person through the pain. Or perhaps the answer is so simple that God leads the person to discover the answer for himself or herself by remaining silent. So this is interesting. God is silent because the answer is too complicated for the sufferer to understand, or God is silent because he wants you to figure it out yourself. I'm even more agnostic than that. I don't know why God is silent during the suffering. I just know that he wants to get you through it, and he's going to get you closer to him when it's all over. Every Christian will tell you that. Now, in verse 25, Elihu says that God recognizes evil people's deeds and overthrows the evil by night. That's an interesting statement. There are lots of examples in the Old Testament of bad guys being overthrown at night. I don't know what that implies. I don't know how important that is, but it is true. Now, of course, we don't know how much of the Old Testament Job knew. He could have been experiencing all this before the Old Testament was even written. I don't know. But just for fun, it's a little rabbit trail. Let's look and see how God overthrows evil people at night. Pharaoh and his host drowned in the Red Sea. I often don't think of that happening as at night, but it did. Exodus 15:4, Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. That mentions nothing about night, but if you back up a chapter and go to Exodus 14:20-21, it came upon the Egyptian and Israelite forces. The cloud was there in the darkness, yet it lit up the night. So neither group came near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back with a powerful east wind all that night, turned the sea into the dry land. So the waters were divided. I assume that all this stuff happened at night, and then Moses takes out in the morning. But if it wasn't at night, it was close to at night. Let's put it that way. How about the Egyptian firstborn? Exodus 12:30, Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. That was at night. The Assyrian army that was attacking Jerusalem during the reign of Hezekiah, Sennacherib's army, Sennacherib the Assyrian, 2 Kings 19:35, that it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians, and when men rose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. How about the Babylonian Empire? Daniel 5:30, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. He was sort of a junior official in the Babylonian Empire, and he was having a drunken banquet while the Persians were at their gate in 539 B.C., and Belshazzar looked at the wall, many Turkel Apharsin, the handwriting on the wall. That was at night. Interesting. God judges people at night. That might just be a coincidence. I don't know. We go now to Job 34, verses 31 through 33. Suppose someone says to God, Elihu continues, that someone says this, quote, I have endured my punishment. I will no longer act wickedly. Teach me what I cannot see. If I have done wrong, I won't do it again. And of course, that someone is Job that he's referring to. Verse 33, Elihu says, should God repay you, Job, he means, should God repay you on your terms when you have rejected his terms? You must choose, not I. So declare what you know. Tell me, Job. Give me an answer. What terms? Job's terms and God's terms. Why should God repay you, Job, on your Job's terms when you have rejected God's terms? Well, Job's terms would be, acquit me. I didn't do anything wrong. God's terms would be, yeah, well, I'll acquit you when you repent for what you did do wrong. And Elihu is saying, Job, you don't have any right to ask for your terms. Now, Elihu is postulating that Job might say to God, I've endured my punishment. Punishment implies that Job did something wrong, which Job is not willing to admit. But Elihu says, why don't you think about this? Just tell God you've put up with your punishment, all this suffering that you've gone through, and I will no longer act wickedly. Notice Elihu assumes that Job has acted wickedly, which Job will maintain to his death. No, I did not act wickedly. So Elihu says, Job, why don't you say some more stuff to God? Why don't you say, teach me what I cannot see. If I've done wrong, I won't do it again. So you see, once again, Elihu is saying the same thing as the three other false friends. Job, you're a sinner. Should God repay you in your terms? In other words, let me off scot-free when you have rejected his terms, which is repent before I let you off. And then Elihu says to Job, you must choose, not I. John Gill says that what Elihu is saying here is that you, Job, must choose whether to submit to God's chastisement or punishment or not submit to it. You so far have not agreed to submit to it because you keep saying you're innocent. But you've got to choose. You need to admit that you're guilty. So declare what you know. In other words, if you know anything better than what I've just said to you, let me hear you. I want to hear you speak. It could mean declare what you know, as in declare what sins you've committed because you know your own sins. Or it could just be, answer me, Job. I don't think you can do it. We go now to Job 34, verses 34 through 37, and we will finish this chapter. Elihu continues, reasonable men will say to me, along with the wise men who hear me, Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without insight. If only Job were tested to the limit, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin, he scornfully claps in our presence, while multiplying his words against God. Now in verse 34, when Elihu says, reasonable men will say to me, Elihu is speaking to the three other false friends. He's saying, you three guys, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, you are reasonable, along with the wise men who hear me. Actually, the wise men probably refers to the three false friends, and reasonable men are just reasonable men in general. In other words, this is an open and shut case. Job speaks without knowledge. He doesn't know what he's talking about. His words are without insight. He's a stupid cement blockhead dolt. And then Elihu continues in verse 36, if only Job were tested to the limit. Oh, really? Tested to the limit? He hasn't been tested to the limit already? He's lost every bit of his property. His wife has abandoned him. He's covered with boils from head to foot, and all of his children have been killed. Oh, he needs to be tested some more? Because his answers are like those of wicked men. In other words, Job has not confessed to sin yet. He needs to be tested a little bit more. He adds rebellion to his sin. He's rebelling against God, so he needs to be tested some more. Job scornfully claps in our presence. That clapping could be in grief and sorrow. It could be in triumph. It could be in scorn. The Home of Christian Study Bible puts in a word that's not in the original text. He scornfully claps. He scornfully claps in our presence. well, whatever the custom was back then, he was not admitting that he had done wrong. He's multiplied his words against God. Now, Elihu was dead wrong about all this, as the NIV Study Bible says. Job was not complaining that God was unjust. He was complaining that God allowed the injustices against him without explaining why. They were unanswered. His questions were unanswered. The other biblical figures expressed their disappointment in God without denying him. Jeremiah, Habakkuk. We'll look for that when we get to Jeremiah and Habakkuk. That's an interesting point that the NIV Study Bible brings out. There's nothing wrong with expressing your disappointment. God, why did you allow this to happen? That doesn't mean that you're denying God. You're just asking, what's going on here? Adam Clark says of Elihu's last blast at Job was, quote, an ill-natured, cruel, and unfounded assertion, borne out by nothing which Job had ever said or intended, and indeed more severe than the most inveterate of his friends, so-called, had ever spoken. Now, we've been saying that Elihu was a little bit gentler with Job. He was in the previous chapters, in verse 33. But now in verse 34, he comes after Job just like the other three false friends, with guns blazing, totally without discretion, without compassion, without mercy. He has said that Job is like that. The words of Job are like the words of wicked men. He's adding rebellion to his sin. He's scornful. So Elihu was just as big an SOB as the other three friends were. So on that unhappy note, we are now finished with chapter 34 of Job. That prepares us to go in our next audio to Job chapter 35, verses 1 through 16. Elihu condemns Job like he hasn't already, but he's going to do it some more. So I hope you stay tuned with me to put up with these unjust words of Elihu in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.